the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. The views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-800-259-5791. That's 1-800-259-5791, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We're hoping, against hope, we're going to have with us for this next hour a Mr. John Allen, who has written a fascinating book on Opus Dei, which is a secret Catholic organization with about 85,000 members throughout the world. And of course, this was portrayed in the book The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown as this a secret organization where this wicked albino monk would actually self-flagellate himself and would wear this chain around his thigh that would inflict pain on him. And this is how, of course, he was gaining sanctity, how he was becoming sanctified by self-flagellation, by beating himself with a whip, and certainly by wearing this chain around his thigh, hidden there, so it would cut into the skin and he would feel the pain. And yet, of course, if you read the book, you will find that these charges of this sort of personal inflicting pain on yourself is absolutely true. And Mr. Allen has had an opportunity to interview the highest people in Opus Dei, and they admit that this sort of thing goes on, at least at the upper echelons of this secret society that is intent upon personal sanctification. Mr. Allen, thank you so very much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Now, you, of course, are a professional writer. You've written for a magazine that deals with the Catholic Church for a long period of time, haven't you?
I have, yes.
All right. Are you yourself a Catholic?
I am, yes.
All right, fine. And your wife is Jewish. And at one point she was accused of being a member of Opus Dei, which you thought was rather ridiculous. But you had a unique opportunity to talk to a lot of people in this secret organization.
That's right. I logged about 300 hours of interviews for the book, not, of course, exclusively with members of Opus Dei, but also with their critics and neutral observers and so on. And traveled to 8 countries. So I think I got a pretty good bird's eye view of the inside reality of the group.
Well, now, do you think that at any point that they might have held back some of the secrets from you? After all, if it's a secret society, wouldn't there be certain things that they would not want people to know?
Well, I don't actually think it is a secret society. I mean, if your model of a secret society is something like Skull and Bones, I mean, Opus Dei clearly doesn't rate. I mean, you know, they don't deny the existence of the organization. They're in the phone book. Their officers are a matter of public record and so on. You know, I don't think the problem with Opus Dei is that they withhold information from you. I think it's that many of their practices can be seen from multiple points of view, and they're, of course, not going to be the ones to take critical perspective. That's why, as a reporter, you have to seek out other points of view, and that's, of course, another part of what I tried to do in the book.
And, of course, you did a great job of giving us an understanding of why people would go into this. I think that, you know, a lot of people look at the world, and we live in a pretty rotten world, and people would like to be better and would really like to make it a better world. Isn't it real, one of the objectives of Opus Dei is not only personal sanctification, but trying to make it a better world?
Yeah, that's right. Opus Dei was born in Spain in 1928, and I think it was a time when a lot of Catholics were trying to figure out how to overcome what they saw as this growing gap between religion and the kind of, you know, workaday secular world, and trying to figure out how the message of the gospel, that is the idea of making things holy, making things better, could be brought to that world. And that was the original impulse of Opus Dei, to train lay men and women who would be doctors and lawyers and bankers and barbers and, you know, bus drivers and so on, who could change the world from within.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with Mr. John Allen, his book, Opus Dei. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is John L. Allen, Jr. He's written a fascinating book on Opus Dei, an objective look behind the myths and reality, the most controversial force in the Catholic Church. And certainly, most people were rather unaware of Opus Dei until Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Code, came out, and talking about this albino monk that was going around killing people. He was flagellating himself, beating himself to inflict pain, wearing this this chain around his thigh. And it sounds like it's pretty absurd that that this would be going on. Of course, there's the conflict between the Opus Dei and something known as the Priory of Sion. I think that the Priory is actually has been sort of a charade created sometime within the last century or so, but Opus Dei has been around, well, since 1928?
That's right.
And would you go ahead and repeat what you said about the reason for it, because now we have new people listening to our program. And really, as I read it, the whole idea of Opus Dei is to produce personal sanctification, but also to change society forever.
That's right. The sort of catchphrase is the sanctification of work. The idea that the founder of Opus Dei, who is now a saint by the name of Jose Maria Escrivá, he wanted to form a group of lay Catholics, that is, ordinary men and women, who would stay where they were, that is, continue doing the lay work they were doing, whether it was law or medicine or politics or, you know, cutting hair or being a stay-at-home mom or whatever it would be, but that they would see that work in a new light. They would see it as an opportunity to make themselves holy, but also as an opportunity to change the world from within, to bring the message of the Christian gospel, love, redemption, compassion, and all of that, to whatever their occupation would be. And the insight here was that if the church is going to change the world, it can't do it from the outside, you know, wagging its finger at it. It has to be done by lay people who were living in that world and who act as a leaven in that world. And so that was the original impulse. Uh-huh. I think a lot of the debate around Opus Dei today is whether or not the institution that's been created and the practices that go with it, you know, serve that objective or not.
And, of course, there's this aura of secrecy about it, and actually some of these people actually lived a very cloistered existence. They live, you talked about the supernumeraries and then the numeraries, and why don't you sort of get into this idea that there are various grades of Opus Dei?
Well, they wouldn't see them as grades. I mean, their understanding is that every member of Opus Dei has exactly the same vocation, but it's expressed in different ways. So you have a group that's called the supernumerarius. That's about 70% of their 85,000 members worldwide. These are people who normally are married.
Hold that thought right there, would you please? And we'll keep... Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this afternoon is John Allen, his book Opus Dei, and he was simply talking about the structure of this organization, which, of course, was popularized recently by Dan Brown in his book, The Da Vinci Code. And there's something called super... There are about 85,000 members of Opus Dei worldwide. And you know, that is not very many. A very, very small proportion of the Catholic Church is part of this secret society, or call it what you will. Anyway, of course, then within this they have something called the supernumeraries, and then they have the numeraries, and then they have associates. So why don't you explain what all of these various levels are?
Sure. So the supernumeraries are, again, 70% of the membership. They're married, they have families, they live out in the world, have ordinary jobs, and so on. The numeraries, which are about 20%, are celibates who live in Opus Dei centers. Now, many of them also have ordinary secular jobs, but some of them work for Opus Dei. There's a group called the associates, who are like the numeraries. They're celibate, but the difference is they don't live in a center. They live with their families. And then there's a very small percentage, about 2.5% of Opus Dei's membership, that are priests that serve the sacramental and spiritual needs of Opus Dei members.
But, of course, the members of Opus Dei are totally submerged in this. I mean, there are certain requirements as far as prayer and attendance at Mass and, you know, taking the Eucharist on a fairly frequent basis. Aren't they almost going to Mass on a daily basis?
Well, sure. Now, there are a lot of Catholics who go to Mass on a daily basis, so it's certainly not just Opus Dei members. But, you know, you are absolutely right that this is, the membership in Opus Dei is seen as a vocation. That is, it is supposed to be just as profound a life commitment as becoming a priest or nun. But the difference is that instead of going to a seminary or going to a monastery, you know, these are, in the main, almost 98% of the membership are lay people. the vast majority of whom are out in the world doing ordinary lay secular occupation. So the idea here is to maintain the same seriousness of commitment, the same depth of religious commitment, but not to retreat from the world, but to stay inside it and to try to change it from within.
Well, of course, basically what you're seeing is that this influence here, but nobody really knows who the Opus Dei are. They don't publish their membership at all, do they?
No. Now, and this is because they have this concept called secularity, which is they don't want to distinguish themselves from everybody else out in the secular world. So they don't broadcast their membership. They don't wear special clothes. They don't put it on their business cards or what have you. But, I mean, on the other hand, I have to say that having done interviews with, you know, hundreds of Opus Dei members across the world, I never once had anyone dodge the question of their membership. If you ask them, are you a member, they quite quickly will acknowledge it. And the other point is that, you know, lots of Opus Dei members who become public figures in one way or another become known, you know, up to and including the Pope's own spokesperson, Joaquin Navarro-Valls, who was an Opus Dei numeri. So again, I think the problem with Opus Dei, in my experience, is not so much that it's secretive. I don't think they're trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes. I think the problem is that the sort of internal self-understanding that this group has is just very different from the way that most organizations in the 21st century structure themselves. So I would say it's not so much secretiveness as it is just uniqueness that's the problem in trying to understand it.
But, of course, there is a total dedication to the organization and supposedly through the organization to God. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, that's certainly the official line, yes, that this is a profound life commitment in the first place to the spiritual path of Opus Dei and through that spiritual path to the sanctification of the world. Now, you know, the truth, the critics, of course, will say that that's largely a smokescreen and that what it disguises is Opus Dei's ambitions to expand its own wealth, power, and influence.
And, of course, it does have a great deal of wealth, doesn't it? In fact, one of the heads of one of the largest banks in Italy came from Opus Dei.
Well, yes, but that doesn't mean the assets of that bank belong to Opus Dei. I mean, you know, actually, Opus Dei's wealth is relatively modest if you compare it to other organizations in the church. I actually run the numbers in the book. Its total assets in the United States come to about $344 million. The total assets worldwide are about $2.8 billion. And to give you some term of comparison, the Archdiocese of Chicago has assets of $2.5 billion. In other words, Chicago by itself is roughly equivalent to Opus Dei's worldwide wealth. Another example would be the Knights of Columbus, which is a lay Catholic organization in the States that has 1.7 million members. It has an insurance program for those members that's capitalized at about $6 billion. In other words, 2.5 times Opus Dei's net worth. And so the point is, while $2.8 billion is not nothing, you know, put in the context of other Catholic organizations, other realities in the church, it's not particularly immense.
But, of course, it's a rather small organization with only 85,000 members, and then, of course, the wealth of that 85,000 members being manifested with a couple of $1 billion. So that, proportionally, isn't that an awful lot of money?
Well, I mean, I say it's not inconsiderable, but I think if you put it in the context of other organizations that have access to similar kind of resources, I would say it comes out to be a fairly average, relatively modest profile.
Well, of course, one of the most famous members was a man named Hansen. He was a member of the FBI. He was also a communist spy. Where did this fit into this whole issue? Why would this man, who is so pious, be betraying his country?
Well, obviously, because he was not living what he professed. And that is to say, if he had been taking the teachings of the Catholic Church, to say nothing of Opus Dei, seriously, very basic things like, you shouldn't lie and you shouldn't betray people, then he shouldn't have been doing any of it. And I would say that in my conversations with Opus Dei members, I would say, as opposed to the Da Vinci Code, which a lot of them are able to just kind of laugh off because in most cases it's just ridiculously exaggerated, that the Hansen thing has been a bit of a gut check for them because, they have to ask themselves, how did we fail to get through to this person? I mean, what was happening in his spiritual direction and his formation that this message just obviously didn't get through? And so I think in that sense it caused them to ask some tough questions about what they need to do to make sure that people aren't just going through the motions and not really absorbing the spiritual message.
Well, was Pat Buchanan a member of Opus Dei?
No, he's not.
All right, fine. So we hear all sorts of things. Maybe it's Knights of Columbus or one of the other organizations that he's a member of, Knights of Malta. Anyway, does this have any relationship to these other organizations like Knights of Malta?
Well, only in the sense that these are all official organizations that that are approved by the Catholic Church. But like, one of the things that has been a characteristic of Opus Dei's history over the years is because it is it's a new concept in the Church, the idea of men and women in clergy and laity all sharing the same vocation and being part of one organic body. That's something that has never been seen before in Church history. And because of that, I think they have been really insistent about how unique they are. That they don't want to be compared to a religious order like the Jesuits or the Dominicans. They don't want to be compared to a lay organization like the Knights of Columbus. And because of that, I think historically they've been very hesitant about working with other groups in the Church or being lumped in with other groups in the Church. And you can kind of understand that, but what it's meant is that they really have sometimes not built very good relationships with other bodies, other currents in the Church, which I think has contributed to this image of them as being somehow secretive or standoffish or elitist, which I think in some sense is unfair, but in another sense, they haven't taken some very common sense steps they could have taken, I think without compromising their identity, to help address some of those concerns.
Well, why would they actually want to inflict pain on themselves, wear this chain linked, whatever it is, with the barbs on it, to dig into their flesh or their thigh, or to beat themselves with cords and bands in on the back?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it should be said that only a minority of the members, the celibates, that is, the priests and the numeraries, do those two things. But why, you ask? Well, the spiritual logic that they give is threefold. One, reminds them of in a physical way of the consequences of sin. Secondly, it's a way of identifying with the suffering of the world. And third, that it's a way of identifying with the suffering of Christ on the cross. It should be said that this has a rich pedigree in Catholic spirituality. Great saints of the past, like St. Francis and St. Dominic, did these things. In the 20th century, figures such as Padre Pio, Pope Paul VI, Mother Teresa, all of them, engaged in these practices. There are a number of other groups in the Church today that do it as well, just you've never heard of them. Now, having said all that, it is certainly also the case that lots of very well-respected spiritual directors and experts on the spiritual life in the Church certainly would not agree with these practices, would say that they're just too easily open to abuse. It's very easy, especially for an idealistic young person, to think that if a little pain is good, a lot of it must be great, and therefore there's a tendency to kind of push it to excess. Now, Opus Dei will insist, they're very careful about that, they insist that the practice be moderate and so on. I think at the end of the day, this is one of those ways in which Opus Dei simply, you know, swims against the cultural tide. And some people admire that in them, other people find it very difficult to swallow.
Well, of course, you know, certainly I believe in personal sanctity. I believe, of course, we should do everything we can to change the world. But, of course, it seems to me that this is man's effort to change the world rather than relying upon God to change it. Did you have that feeling at all as you read this? In other words, it's all based upon the works of men. We are going to change it, and not leaving much room there for God to do it, intervene.
Well, that's been a criticism of Opus Dei from inside the Church over the years. There are some who have called them the Catholic Calvinists. That is, this very strong emphasis on a work ethic and so on. That's true. All I can say is that's not how they understand it. You know, their argument would be that this effort, this emphasis on an excellence in work and on, you know, going the last mile to try to do the work of God in the world, they would see all of that as a response, in the first place, to God's gracious gift, God's gracious offer of love to them. So they would insist that they do not believe that by performing these works they are earning redemption or earning God's love. Instead, they see themselves doing all this as a response to a gift that's already been given. How that works out in terms of each individual Opus Dei member, their own spirituality and their own psychology, of course, is not for me to say.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment or two. Our guest this afternoon is John Allen, and of course his book is Opus Dei, an objective look behind the myths and reality, the most controversial force in the Catholic Church. And when we get back, perhaps we can talk a little bit about what the people who have been in the order and left the order have to say about it. Fascinating, because of course these are people who really know what it's about from the inside.
except genocide. And one of the tapes is an interview with a Dr. Dinigan, who heard back in 1969 actually a talk given by Dr. Day, who would later become the president of Planned Parenthood. And Dr. Day laid out the whole plan for America, the fact there are too many people, the fact that we're going to have to create new diseases, the fact that we're going to have to conceal some of the very obvious treatments for cancer, because people are going to have to die of something. They might as well die of cancer. An incredible interview, and a series of other interviews that will go into the background of what is happening in America, why new diseases are cropping up all the time. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR for copies of our four-tape set, Genocide. It's vitally important that you help us to get this message out across America, because without knowledge, my people perish. America, our values, our future are under attack today.
And, of course, Dr. Day was actually the medical director of Planned Parenthood.
There was a group of Italian immigrants in the small town of Rosetto, Pennsylvania, who drew worldwide attention for their unusual cardiovascular health, despite their pasta diets. I recently uncovered the fact that their unusual health was attributed to the precious red wine which they imported from Italy. Today we know this as the French paradox, the fact that the French exhibit greater cardiovascular health, despite their fatty diet, because of the red wine they drink. Wouldn't it be great to enjoy the health benefits of red wine without the calories, alcohol, and sulfite preservatives? Well, now you can with Longevinex, the world's first stabilized red wine molecules, preserved in an airtight capsule just like in a sealed bottle of red wine, equivalent to 5 glasses of the best red wine. Call 866-405-4000 to order Longevinex for healthy aging without the calories and alcohol. 866-405-4000.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Thierry. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Hi, this is Joyce Riley, and most of you now know why so many people agree that Miracle 2 soap really is a miracle. Miracle 2 products are now being used by farmers and ranchers to increase their yield. Mechanics and machinists use it in their shops. Chiropractors and physicians are using Miracle 2, and the uses are simply too numerous to mention. Dr. Stan and the folks at Radio Liberty knew right away that the listeners would benefit tremendously by using Miracle 2 products. You can enjoy the benefits of Miracle 2 and help Radio Liberty continue to broadcast Dr. Stan's message by calling 800-544-8927 to order your Miracle 2 today. After you've tried Miracle 2 around the house, you'll probably do just what so many others have done. Get rid of all those toxic cleaners and chemicals under your sink. Call Radio Liberty and order your Miracle 2 today. 800-544-8927. 800-544-8927. Dr. Stan Monteith and so many listeners know that Miracle 2 soap isn't just soap. It's a miracle.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, I guess, this afternoon. This is John Allen. His book is Opus Dei. And now, of course, you've had the opportunity to talk to many people who've left the order, who seem to have, some criticisms of it. Would you like to perhaps get into what are the criticisms of the people who've left the order?
Sure. Well, I mean, the first thing that probably should be said is that not everyone who has left Opus Dei is critical. Some of them say they had good experiences, stayed friends with people in Opus Dei, and so on. But there certainly are, certainly is a large number of former members of Opus Dei around the world who do have a number of criticisms to offer about their experience. Some of them would say that they felt they were manipulated in some ways into joining Opus Dei, either because there was a very strong sort of sales pitch that was applied, or because people established friendships with them that they felt turned out to be instrumental, that is, aimed only at getting them to join rather than any honest concern. Some say that they felt they were subjected to excessive control while they were inside Opus Dei, that their contacts with their families were sort of cut off, that their comings and goings were monitored. Some would say their consciences were invaded, that they were compelled to reveal things, private things, to their spiritual directors that they really didn't want to talk about. Some will say that they were simply overworked and overextended and pushed too far. And I suppose, in the end, what it boils down to is that there are a number of ex-members who say that they were subjected to a regimen of control and surveillance and subjected to demands that were simply inhuman. And as I say, this isn't just, two or three isolated people, but we're talking about certainly several dozen, at least, ex-members around the world who say these things. I also hasten to add that I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of current members and several dozen ex-members who say that nothing of the kind happened to them. So at the end of the day, as a journalist, you have to ask yourself, when you have conflicting testimony like that, what do you do with it? And the only conclusion I can draw is that, although you have to go case by case, I think in the main, it is not that one party is lying and the other telling the truth. I think probably, in many instances, what's happening is that both parties are honestly describing their experiences, but they're filtering those experiences through a very different point of departure. I think it is true there's a lot of structure inside Opus Dei. The bar is set very high in terms of expectations of members. In that sense, I suppose it's a little bit like a Catholic version of the Marine Corps. And I think there's a certain kind of person who likes that structure and responds to it and feels liberated by it. There's another kind of person who feels ground down and overextended by that structure and ends up seeing it as manipulative and destructive.
Well, of course, you mentioned something like the Marine Corps. When you enter the service, whether it be the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, they get you in, they get you exhausted. They yell at you, they force you to do it. They change your personality, and that is the purpose. That you take the raw recruits off of the streets of New York City and San Francisco, and you send them through boot camps, and 6 weeks later, they're different people. And it really sounds, reading your book, as if many times these people are really pushed beyond the limits to the point where they almost are now being molded by the people who control them. Is this the impression you got talking to some of the people?
Well, I think that is how some of the critical ex-members would see it. Now, on the other hand, I think that both the kind of satisfied current members and satisfied ex-members would say that wasn't how they experienced it, that they were looking for a kind of structure and a program of life in a community that would give them direction and that would help them, give them tools to become the kind of people that they wanted to be based on what they see as God's design for authentic human happiness. And so again, I say that I think a lot of this just depends on how you see the program that Opus Dei offers. Do you see it as liberating and a positive thing, or do you see it as controlling and manipulative? And I think in many ways it's the exact same experience, but it just sort of depends on what perspective you end up deciding to bring to it.
But of course, the thing, the isolation from your friends, from your former life, from your family, this is almost what they do with the Moonies. And so many of the people who become Moonies, they love it. You can't get them out of it unless you deprogram them, because they've been programmed. Why would they cut them off? Why would they prevent them from having contact with the outer world?
Well, Opus Dei denies that they do that, and I have to tell you that I've spoken to Opus Dei members all over the world who do not, to me at least, appear at all cut off from their families. I mean, I've been with Opus Dei members when they visited their families, when they were at reunions and so on. So I think some of this perhaps happened to some extent in the past, as it did, I must say, in Catholic seminaries and Catholic religious communities all over the board in the years before the Second Vatican Council in the 60s. I think it's much less common today.
Well, did you encounter that sort of a description, though, from some of the people you talked to?
I did, yes, although I think it should be said that in most cases this description was being given to me by people who had left Opus Dei.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back in just a minute.
Have you ever wondered what the Vietnamese War was really all about? Why America, the most powerful nation in the world, spent 10 years fighting in Southeast Asia against a nation the size of the state of Mississippi, and America lost that war? Do you really believe that happened by accident? There's so much to the story of Vietnam that the American people have never really known. And in our four-tape set, Vietnam, The Untold Story, you're going to get the information that you need to understand the tragedy of that event. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for Vietnam, The Untold Story, the story of what really happened in Vietnam that has been suppressed from the American people for the last 20 years.
Sophisticated investors are buying gold and silver today because the dollar has lost almost 50% of its value in relationship to the euro, and the price of gold and silver has increased almost 40%. If you're interested in learning more about precious metal investing, why don't you call Bo at 831-423-0177. That's 831-423-0177, or visit him at Elliott's Stamp and Coin Shop in downtown Santa Cruz at 141 South River Street in the San Lorenzo office building, which is located between Trader Joe's and the Signature Twin Movie Theater. Bo's telephone number is 831-423-0177. That's 831-423-0177. And he's located at 141 South River Street in the San Lorenzo office building. And if you mention you heard about Elliott Stamp and Coin Shop on Radio Liberty, why, you'll get a 15% discount on some non-investment items.
Leading-edge dentists know the profound effect dental materials and procedures have on the health of the entire body. If you've been searching for a holistic trained dentist who can safely treat you, look no further. Dr. David Biles has been a leader in the Santa Cruz dental community for nearly 20 years. He built a solid reputation providing exceptionally high-quality cosmetic and restorative dental care long before learning the very real hazards of common dental practices. Now, as a faculty member of the Institute of Natural Dentistry, Dr. Biles has begun lecturing nationally to other dentists on alternative and complementary dental care. On request, Dr. Biles will safely remove toxic dental materials from your mouth while substituting them with safe, non-allergenic restorations. Call Dr. Biles today and take the next step to improve your health. With sedation and nitrous oxide available, Dr. Biles can help even the most anxious patients. Call 423-0121 and schedule a visit now. That's 423-0121.
When was the last time you used Pure Soap? I mean real, hard-to-find, all-natural Pure Soap that contains no dyes, perfumes, deodorant. Probably never.
Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, our guest this afternoon is John Allen. His book is Opus Dime, and a fascinating look into the background of this organization, which really has only become well known, I think we should say, since the advent of Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Code. And you talk about a book that was written by a man who had actually been part of this called The Kingdom Come, or Thy Kingdom Come, something of that sort. And the man who was writing the book was suggesting that the organization, or at least members of the organization, had played a powerful part in currency manipulation. What was the background of that?
Well, I'm not sure I'm quite familiar with the specific anecdote you're talking about, but what I can say in general is that over the years there have been any number of rumors about Opus Dei's involvement in the global financial markets, in stock trading, and so on. And I think probably the root of most of that is that there are some members of Opus Dei, a relatively small number, but they're there, who have risen to positions of prominence in banking, finance, industry, and so on. For example, the former president of the largest bank in Spain, who just retired last year, was an Opus Dei numerary. And I think, what many people will do is they will connect the dots that if an Opus Dei member is doing something, therefore it must be an Opus Dei activity. In a way that you wouldn't necessarily do if you learned that the president of the bank was a member of the Rotary Club, for example. You know, Opus Dei's argument always is that the professional activities of its members are its own business, and that and they're not responsible for them, nor do they benefit from them.
All right. Well, now as far as the criticism of it concerned, do you think that this permeates much of the Catholic Church, or do you think most of the people feel, as long as it's authorized by the Vatican, that it's perfectly all right?
Oh, I'm sure some people feel that way, but I think, you know, how widespread outright opposition to Opus Dei is, I don't know. That's probably restricted to some fairly small circles. It would include a number of self-identified liberal Catholics who don't like what they see as Opus Dei's conservatism, and then there would, of course, be the constituency of ex-members who have remained Catholics, nevertheless, but who feel that Opus Dei is, in some sense, betraying the Church. But I think probably the other set of people would be those who, while they may not be an outright opposition to Opus Dei, they certainly would be a little skeptical. They would, you know, kind of not know what to make about it because they've heard all sorts of things in the press and in the Da Vinci Code and on TV and so on, and would just be a little unsettled and a little dubious. I think that probably is an awfully large number of Catholics out there. You know, one of the problems of Opus Dei, of course, is that only having 85,000 members worldwide, and there are 1.1 billion Catholics in the world, you know, the typical Catholic has never met anyone from Opus Dei. So they're almost entirely dependent upon, you know, what's in the air. And so I think, you know, probably the real challenge facing Opus Dei is not so much converting their most ardent critics, because I don't think they're ever going to do that, but I think the challenge facing Opus Dei is trying to reassure the concerns of that just, you know, meat and potatoes average Catholic out there, who doesn't know what to think, but is a little bit dubious because of things they've heard. I mean, that's the group they've got to reach.
But, of course, they really want to change the world, don't they? Don't they want not only personal sanctification, but to use their collective efforts to alter the world?
Well, they want to change the world, yes, but I'm not sure collective efforts is quite the right way to put it, because it's an article of faith for Opus Dei that they don't act as a group, that the idea is to provide spiritual and doctrinal formation for their members, and then sort of turn them loose on the world, and then trust their members in their own freedom, using their own responsibility to figure out what a Christian approach to politics or to law or to architecture or to medicine or whatever would look like. And so, yeah, they want to change the world, but not through the ordinary means that we would think of a kind of interest group pursuing an agenda. Rather, it's an effort to form people who, acting as individuals, will one by one change their own piece of the world, with the idea that that will have a ripple effect that creates a momentum that that sooner or later will be noticed.
Well, one of the things you pointed out is when you join Opus Dei, do you call it Dei or Dei?
Opus Dei.
Opus Dei. You have to sign a contract. And of course, this is so actually so familiar today because we have a movement sweeping the Protestant Church. As you might suspect, I'm Protestant. But of course, when you get into this, you have to sign a contract. So you have to sign a contract with when you get into the Opus Dei. But that's been around for a long time. Has that contract been there going all the way back to the 1928 period?
Yeah, it was formalized shortly after 1928, so it would have been the early 30s when they adopted that particular instrument. And here again, the idea was to distinguish themselves from a religious order or from the priesthood. You know, priests in religious communities like the Jesuits and Franciscans and so on, they take vows. Nuns take vows. But Opus Dei insists that it is about ordinary lay men and women who remain in the secular world. And of course, in the secular world, if you want to make a binding agreement with someone, you don't take vows, you make a contract. And so that's the instrument that they adopted.
And so they sign this contract that they pledge their allegiance to the group, and the group says that they're going to work with them. And what is it, this name of the group, they call it, the Prelate, something of the sort?
Yeah, the Opus Dei, let me take a step back and say the Catholic Church has its own body of law called the Code of Canon Law. Which dates all the way back to it's based on ancient Roman law. In the Code of Canon Law, every group in the Church has to have its own category. And so the category for Opus Dei is something called a personal prelature, which essentially means, if we take that apart, a prelate in the Church is a clergyman, a bishop, or a monsignor. So this means a group that is headed by a prelate. personal means that your membership in it is defined not by geography, like it is with the Archdiocese of Los Angeles or whatever, but it's defined by your personal decision to join. So it's a personal prelature. And to date, although this category has existed in canon law since 1983, Opus Dei is the only example of it.
All right, fine. Well, after you've spent a great deal of time analyzing and studying it and talking to people, what is your ultimate decision? How do you view this? What part is it playing in the world we live in today, and what impact is it having on the world?
Well, I think from a certain point of view, I think Opus Dei's impact has probably been fairly considerably overestimated. Certainly, for those who think it is a kind of, you know, cult-like force that is exercising vast behind-the-scenes influence on, you know, global politics and finance and inside the Catholic Church, I think that's overstating the case. But I do think Opus Dei illustrates two fairly important trends inside Roman Catholicism. One is what I've come to call the Wojtyla Revolution, Wojtyla being the last name of Pope John Paul II. John Paul, when he came on the scene in October 78, was determined to change the terms of debate in the Catholic Church and to resolve the debate between progressives and traditionalists to a great extent in favor of the traditionalists. And so in that sense, Opus Dei was a bit the boat that was lifted highest by that tide. Secondly, the Catholic Church these days tends to be in many ways quite polarized, that is, fragmented into different constituencies that often don't think well of one another. And I think that some of the hysteria and the controversy and so forth that has surrounded Opus Dei over the years is perhaps the leading case in point of that phenomenon. And part of the hope in doing the book, to be honest with you, is that if we could clear a space in which we can have a bit more rational conversation about Opus Dei, and one a bit more grounded in fact rather than fiction, then perhaps that would be an object lesson that would help the Church wrestle with some of its other very deep divisions.
All right, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you're out there and you'd like to ask Mr. Allen a question about his very, very provocative book, Opus Dei. Now, certainly this has the blessing of the Vatican, doesn't it, and the full support of the Vatican?
That's right. John Paul II, Opus Dei has been fully approved by church authority from the very beginning, but if there were any doubt about how lasting that was going to be, John Paul II, I think, clearly resolved it. He made Opus Dei a personal prelature in 1982. He beatified the founder, Jose Maria Escrivá, Spanish priest, in 1992. Beatification is the last step before sainthood. And then in 2002, he canonized, meaning formally, made Escrivá a saint. So I think at the end of all of that, there is no doubt that this organization is firmly embraced and approved by church authority.
Well, of course, at one time, though, wasn't the founder of this actually almost accused of heresy?
Not almost. I mean, he was accused of heresy in 1943. I think one of the ironies about Opus Dei's history is that although today a lot of people would think of it as a kind of far right-wing outfit, in the early days in Spain, because it was new, and because it was talking about laity rather than clergy, and because it was talking about, you know, the street and ordinary work rather than what goes on inside church, it was seen as left-wing avant-garde of the Catholic Church. Just goes to show you what time will do. What was heresy in 1943 today strikes most people as just common sense.
Well, of course, the church, though, dramatically changed, you know, when they had the Second Vatican Council. All the traditions, that I had equated with the Catholic Church, the nuns that I worked in their hospital, and they all had these beautiful names, and suddenly those names were gone. They changed their garb. Everything changed. It was almost like a total transformation of the Catholic Church at the time of the Second Vatican Council. Where did Opus Dei stand on those? And those dramatic changes, wasn't there simply a feeling that maybe they've gone too far? Maybe we should stick to the old, tried and true, basis of the Catholic faith?
Oh, no question. You asked where did Opus Dei stand in the council. Actually, a couple of important Opus Dei people were a part of the the theologians and other experts who helped produce the documents of the Council. But so I think Opus Dei certainly would support and embrace the 17 documents that Vatican II actually produced. I think, however, many Opus Dei members, up to and including the founder, Saint Jose Maria Escrivá, had very serious reservations about the period immediately after the Council, when they felt that lots of people were simply taking things too far and that the baby was being tossed out with the bathwater. And so I think they would, in general, Opus Dei members would be part of a kind of broad counter-reaction, if you like, within the Catholic Church, insisting upon recovering some of the traditional devotions, some of the traditional customs, and you know, in a more conservative or traditional reading of much of the Church's doctrine. And so in the post-Vatican II debate between the liberals, who wanted to carry the reforms even farther, and the conservatives, who wanted to draw the line and perhaps in some ways revisit some of those debates, most Opus Dei members, I would say probably the overwhelming majority, would have been identified and still are today with the conservatives.
And the conservatives are the ones who really would like to get back to the Latin Mass and the traditions and the fasting on Friday and a lot of the saints that they suddenly just liquidated, as it were. You know, many of the people, you know, Catholics, they had their favorite saints and they were no longer saints. That must have been a very, very traumatic thing for many of the old-line traditional Catholics.
Well, I suppose that's symbolic of things, but I suppose that really the deeper issues, I think, among conservatives who feel that too much was squandered after the Council would be, first of all, in the Church's liturgy, that is, its rites, its rituals, its sacraments, that they feel that they were overly hastily modernized, and that much of the reverence and the sobriety and the beauty and the meaning of those rituals was lost, and they are quite eagerly wanting to recapture some of that. Secondly, they would say that that the Church sort of very too hastily embraced the kind of modern world without being sufficiently critical of it, and so there is a kind of reassertion of traditional Catholic identity to emphasize not so much what we have in common with the modern world, but what makes us different from it. I think there's also a sense that too many Catholics adopted a kind of cafeteria Catholicism model, meaning that we can kind of pick and choose among the teachings of the Church, decide what we like, what we don't, and kind of assemble our own platter. And I think some of the conservatives want and have wanted for some time a kind of reassertion of discipline, saying, no, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound. You either accept the authority of the Church and therefore embrace its teachings, or you don't, you know, there's no such thing as being kind of partially on board. And so I think across all of those issues, there have been some titanic struggles that continue inside Roman Catholicism. But I certainly think John Paul II gave the Church an enormous nudge in the direction of the conservative critique on some, though not all, but some of these issues. And in that sense, the prominence of Opus Dei under John Paul's pontificate is, in a sense, the story in microcosm of where the broader Roman Catholic Church has been going.
All right, fine. And then certainly my impression of Opus Dei was, you know, well, this is really is an effort for personal piety. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, in the first place, it's an effort at personal piety, but it is also supposed to have broader social consequences. That is, you know, the world should be different because Opus Dei is in it.
And, of course, here you've got 85,000 people working, and they're really not expanding that rapidly, are they?
No. I mean, you know, Opus Dei has been around since 28, and they've only reached 85,000 members. They add about 650 members a year worldwide, so it is not the kind of, you know, voracious recruiting machinery that the mythology would suggest.
And, of course, they don't you actually have to ask to join the organization?
Well, not only do you have to ask, but you have to wait. I mean, actually, from your first contact making a permanent commitment to Opus Dei, there has to be a period of 6.5 years. So it's not like you can walk in off, it's not the Marines or the Army where you can walk in on Tuesday and be on a bus on Friday.
All right, so you, and then of course once you get in, why, there's this period of time where, before you actually make that final commitment, but then once you've made that final commitment and you've signed the contract, how do you get out of it? If 20 years down the line, you really feel that you've been taken advantage of, or this is not the sort of life you want to lead.
Well, I mean, what most people in that situation do is simply pack their bags and leave. I mean, it's not like the doors are locked. I mean, there's no impediment. I mean, in theory, if you want to kind of follow the rules, you are supposed to write a letter to the prelate. If you've already made your permanent commitment, you are supposed to write a letter to the prelate, you know, communicating your intentions to leave and wait for a response, and then go. But, you know, in real life, what most people do is simply walk out, and that does happen.
And, of course, some people leave, and they think very kindly of it, and others have been extremely critical, and you've actually have quoted some of the things that have been written by them as well. This is a fascinating read. Where can people get your book?
Find bookstores everywhere, Amazon.com, or, you know, with their local bookseller.
And are you on a tour at the present time?
I am. Yeah, I was in New York early in the week doing the Today Show and other things. I'm in Washington now for some media, and then flying back to Rome tomorrow afternoon.
All right, fine. Well, thank you so very much for being with us. It's been a real pleasure to have you with us.
It was a treat. Good luck to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Really help you to understand the nature of the spiritual battle in which we're currently involved is Gary Carr's book, The Demonic Roots of Globalism. Now, you may remember Gary Carr's book, Inward to Global Occupation. His second book, The Demonic Roots of Globalism, goes into the very real spiritual forces, the dark and sinister spiritual forces which have energized those people who are molding the world in which we live today. Going to the background of Masonry, Theosophy, and he actually quotes extensively from the writings of these people who have helped to mold the events of the 20th century. The Demonic Roots of Globalism by Gary Carr will give you tremendous insight into the background of what's happening in America today. And unless you understand the spiritual forces at work, you really can't understand the unfolding of events. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for The Demonic Roots of Globalism by Gary Carr.
When was the last time you used Pure Soap? I mean real, hard-to-find, all-natural Pure Soap that contains no dyes, perfumes, deodorants, or antibacterials. Probably never, right? Hey, folks, Michael Trudeau here, and I want to tell you about my friend Marty. He's the owner and founder of the Calben Soap Company. For the past 55 years, the Calben Soap Company's been making triple-concentrated Pure Soaps exclusively for healthcare professionals and hospitals. Now, for the first time, Calben Pure Soap is available factory-direct to you and your family. Calben Pure Soap is made from all natural ingredients. It's earth-friendly and it's safe. Call the Calben Soap Company today toll-free at 1-800-340-7091. That's 1-800-340-7091. Save up to 85% off supermarket and retail store prices. Visit them on the web at calbenpuresoap.com or call for information at 1-800-340-7091. That web address again is calbenpuresoap.com. Try Pure Soap once, and I guarantee you'll never use anything else.
You know, when I was growing up, my parents weren't worried about our education. We were taught the basics of math and English, science and history, the joy of art and music, and the need for sports. And our generation turned out leaders in every field. But as a parent today, I am concerned with my child's education. That's why I chose VHM Christian School. I know that at VHM, my children are getting a quality education with a biblical foundation. I'm not worried whether they'll be prepared. I know they are. VHM gives my children the tools to succeed and instills moral values. There are so many issues for me to be concerned about. I'm glad my children's education is not one of them. Won't you call VHM today? Your child is worth it. Call 475-4762. That's VHM Christian School at 475-4762.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when we need to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we, of course, hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, and you do that simply by joining the Radio Liberty family, and for a suggested gift of $20 a month or more, you'll get our four best tapes of the month or CDs of the month. You'll get our monthly newsletter, but more than that, you'll be helping us as we reach out across America on about 60 stations every week, about 30-some stations every single day, bringing people the information they're not going to get elsewhere. So if you'd like to become part of our team, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we do hope many of you will go to our website at radioliberty.com, where you can actually listen to our programs on the Internet 5 hours a day directly, or on the other sites. We do the American Freedom Network. We do the Genesis Network. We do the Radio Liberty Network. And, of course, you can find out about that on our Internet site. You can listen to our archive programs as well. And we hope that, of course, you'll copy many of those programs and get other people to listen to them, because we need to get people to understand that we're involved in a spiritual battle being played out on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. Feel free to pull down our newsletters and copy them and distribute them as well. And we've actually taken many of our newsletters. For instance, we've taken all of the newsletters on what happened on September 11th and put it into three pamphlets, each one about 40 pages or more, called Foreknowledge 9111, 2, and 3. And then you can get all three of them for $9.95. Same thing with our occult hierarchy. To understand the secret societies, and there really are secret societies, not one, but a whole lot of them out there that nobody ever wants to talk about. And yet, of course, if you read the book by the Librarian of Congress, James H. Billington, he will tell you that the whole world revolution movement, which started with the American and French Revolution and has continued since then, was based upon secret occult societies. And we bring this out, I think, quite well in our occult hierarchy, Part 1, Part 2, Part 3. If you have not yet read Brotherhood of Darkness, seen the video, or heard the tape, you need to. It's all the same story, pointing you to an understanding that these organizations do exist. They hide their existence in plain sight. You see it on the back of the dollar bill. What's a pyramid doing back there? How many pyramids are there in America outside of Las Vegas? I think that one in Tennessee, and they're all simulating what's going on in Egypt. So what does Egypt have to do with America? It has everything to do with America. Until you understand, there have always been two forces in America, one the Christian and one the occult. And there really have been the secret societies here, planning for hundreds of years, going back almost 350 years with a plan to use America's wealth and America's military power to bring democracy to the whole world. And that's what it's all about. We're going to bring democracy to the whole world and create this world government. And then, of course, we will have a ruling oligarchy, and we will have a one spiritual ruler, and that will, of course, be the Antichrist. You need to understand that what's going on is certainly part and parcel of God's plan, and it's described in the scriptures. And when you begin to understand that Israel was created in one day Israel was created, and of course the Jews today from all over the world are returning to the Holy Land. We're moving towards a situation where you'll neither buy nor sell unless you have your credit card or your mark or your implanted chip. And we're going to, of course, have to implant those chips, because after all, that's how we're going to defeat Osama bin Laden, who's living over a cave in Pakistan. We're really going to thwart those Pakistan, fighting those terrorists, by putting chips into everyone. Isn't that logical? We're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our website, Radio Liberty. Pray for America. Pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And till tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.